Just want to remind you what we did last time, which was talk about faith as an act of buddhi or intelligence, and then discuss the role of intelligence, especially in its function of establishing mindsets or paradigms. And then we talked about paradigms and paradigm shifts and paradigm conflicts as described by Thomas Kuhn, and show how when these paradigms take place within the tradition of empirical science, they have certain characteristics which also show that these kinds of things, these determinations of paradigms, happen on the platform, not on the mental platform, but on the platform of buddhi. And I also wanted to associate that this is all by way of giving a theory of knowledge, that a determination of intelligence or an act of faith is really a precondition for knowledge, and that knowledge always takes place within a frame of reference, a context which is built around ideas of what is interesting, what is important, what basic categorical schemes we deal with. These frames of reference are usually established not by an individual, but are socially established. And maybe even an individual comes up with their first paradigm. If he can't convince other people to buy into it, he's a nut. As soon as he gets a certain number of people, then it becomes a movement. So you need the social, the sociologists have called this the social construction of reality. Now, one thing about this way of looking at things is you can get very worried about being relativistic about the whole thing. Well, they're just different socially constructed realities. The socially constructed reality I'm going to talk about is the one established by Krishna. In other words, I want, from my point of view, there is a privileged paradigm, which is not just one paradigm among others, but is the paradigm given by Krishna, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, there are many other questions that could follow from this, like what if he gives more than one paradigm at different times in different places, and that can be dealt with. But I just wanted to point out something to you by way of starting. The paradigm shift, or the paradigm difference, this thing is called when paradigms collide or something. And I quoted this verse, what is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled, and the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sages. Well, now listen to the Prabhupada's explanation of this verse. And now, having heard about buddhi and faith and paradigms, maybe we'll understand this a little deeper. He says, this is how he begins his purport, there are two classes of intelligent men. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification, and the other is introspective and awake to the cultivation of self-realization. So you see, when he says one is two classes of intelligent, one is intelligent, and in other words, they are directing their attention and their endeavors and their activities toward this particular end. And here he wants to say the real distinction, day and night, is self-realization and sense gratification. These are the two, the ultimate paradigms in collision that I want to talk about. So another place illustrates the same sort of use of intelligence as in here. Here's a sentence when he's discussing intelligence. Persons infatuated by material consciousness are very intelligent in discovering things from material comforts, but they have no access to understanding the spirit soul and spiritual life. We'll come back to this passage tomorrow. Well, this is Canto 3, Chapter 26. This is in the purport to Text 31. Now, another thing to bring in the social dimension, there's also a discussion of Shraddha in goodness, passion, and ignorance in the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Part of our paradigm that we get from Krishna, which we'll discuss, is this sattva, rajas, and gunas is a way of looking at the world. And so I'm anticipating a little bit. He says, everyone has a particular type of faith. I'm saying faith is a universal condition, I believe what was discussed here this morning about stage one. You've got faith. And I said, when I became a devotee, I realized that was an act of faith, but it would have been an equal act of faith not to have become a devotee. And by act of faith, I meant that there was that decision. I could not see any rational grounds for ultimately justifying it, because all grounds were at stake in that depth of that decision. I mean, of course, rational considerations play into it. But as Kuhn talks about, there's a circularity involved. Anyway, he says, everyone has a particular type of faith, regardless of what he is. But his faith is considered good, passionate, or ignorant according to the nature he has acquired. Thus, according to his particular type of faith, one associates with certain persons. So that's when you build up your reality, because if one is inclined one way, then that's the kind of persons one is attracted to and associate with, and that your whole worldview becomes constructed and reinforced in group. Another thing that Prabhupada says in talking about devotees, when he talks about faith, he says that faith is created by association with devotees. Faith is created by association with devotees, which is why that's a very important, especially in the beginning. We say to people, associate with devotees. Do not associate with materialistic people. And then the later, you know, when things are well established, then you can become a little more open in one's association, but still one has to be careful. So that's just to illustrate this kind of social component by which our paradigms are established and work together. So I would like to say that if we look at what is going on with this idea of Shraddha, faith as commitment, as determination, as will. That really, when we see what Prabhupada says here, we could define Shraddha as a commitment to a particular style of life. When we look at what a devotee needs to do, he has to have a kind of, when we say vyavasa atmika bhuti, it's a kind of single-minded or dedicated commitment to a very demanding course of action. That's what we have to undergo. So that requires, the other thing to realize is this kind of thinking, we're talking about paradigms, they're always, or theories, at least in the Vedic context, there's not a theory that isn't related to some form of action. The Purva Mimamsa is right when it says that all Vedic statements have to do with action. And in this way, what you see is, at least, out of the pragmatic tradition in America, there's an analysis of knowledge as basically, to put it simply, true is that which works. And there's some similarity in Krishna consciousness, because any kind of paradigm that we're given is not just there for our amusement or to look at, but is rather a guide for activity, spiritual activity, and for realization. So what we have to have, the reason we have to have Shraddha is not just that I believe certain propositions are true, but rather I have to be committed to, in a single-minded way, to a demanding course of activities. And that's why certain things are needed for me to have that commitment. One of which, very important, which is allegiance to an exemplary devotee, the position of the spiritual master. Here's somebody that is a successful person or an ideal person in this course of activity, and by looking at that person, I can have the commitment that it can be done, and with this person's help, it's doable by me also. That's why you have to have that sort of thing there. So, what it seems to me that ISKCON is about is ultimately anybody who comes and at least joins this society, is we have become committed to self-realization, the Prabhupada called self-realization as the ultimate goal of life. And if we want to become initiated devotees, when we become initiated, what we are doing is saying, this is the main thing in my life, the development of Krishna consciousness, and everything else in my life, I am subordinating to this central activity. It's not that I can't have other activities, but all those other activities have to be in support of this central thing. This is what meant by being single-minded in Krishna consciousness. And I think at least the appeal to me with Krishna consciousness is somehow or other, from meeting devotees and so on, I became convinced that somehow or other, becoming a real saint was a doable thing. It was a vocational goal. I'd read about saints in the past, and I thought that was something that happened way back then, and nowadays that's not done anymore. But then when I met devotees and met Prabhupada, what they're saying is you can be, actually, see God face to face. Not that God is some theory we read about in some book, but you can actually, Prabhupada said, see God as you are seeing me and I am seeing you. Prabhupada said you can have direct spiritual perception of Krishna in relation to him. And he just told us you can do it. In fact, he used the word easy occasionally, which has been misinterpreted. Why did you tell Americans anyway, easy? I think you pop it in the microwave oven and it comes out in a few days. But he said it was, when Prabhupada said Krishna consciousness is practical, what he meant by practical means it can be done. It's in the United States, people would say doable. We can do it. So what we are given then by Prabhupada and by Krishna is a certain way of looking at the world, a kind of categorical scheme, a map of the way things are, which if we take that categorical scheme, if we take those categories of understanding, if we take that worldview and we use it as a guide to the way we see and the way we act, it will take us on the course of self-realization. The world is a very big and complicated place. It's more complicated than any of us can ever understand. Certainly, when Krishna gives us his categorical scheme of things, it's simplified. But that's okay. It's good for the purposes that we want to attain, and it will work for that purposes. That's our and if it works, it's true. That's oversimplifying thing, but how else do you find out if something is true or not? So, like for example, just to give an example of a map, Krishna gives us a map right in the beginning of the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And the first time I read Krishna's description, I was dubious, because he says to Arjuna, I shall now declare to you in full this knowledge, both phenomenal and noumenal. This being known, there's nothing more to know. And I thought, come on, you know, this little book, is you going to tell us everything? But he does. He does. But he gives it's a map. He says, first of all, there is earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. These are my eight separated material energies. Right? That's the first thing you need to know. Here's the material energy. Earth, water, fire, air, ether. Okay, that's really primitive, right? We don't do that anymore. Now we have hydrogen, helium, and, you know, up the periodical table of energies, and it's so complicated and intricate. And here Krishna turns around, and in the 20th century, we're supposed to think, you know, earth, water, fire, air, ether. Well, first of all, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur puts it in a different kind of language. He says, solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy and space. So immediately we feel better. Because it's in terms of density. You know, it's the Sankhya system where earth has five ton mantras or sense qualities and water four and so on to ether. From subtle, from gross to subtle. In other words, subtle means less perceptible to our senses. So that ether is space. Which is not nothing. It has certain properties. Even modern science, Sadaputta says, if you want to describe empty space in quantum mechanics, it takes pages of mathematics. So it's not just nothing. Anyway, that's Krishna's scheme. And then he goes on, and that basically, that's material science, earth, water, fire, air, ether. That is. Then you get this other stuff, which are subtler still, manas, buddhi, and ahankara. Basically what we would call mind. And of course we find out that mind is matter. And it's divided up into this intricate way of manas, buddhi, and ahankara. Mind, intelligence, and ego, or false ego, as we say. We've already discussed the difference between manas and buddhi. And then there's ahankara. That's my subtle material energy, he says. Now, you may wonder about this scheme. And then there's, you know, other schemes. This is part of another scheme of Sankhya where they also list other things as elements, the three modes of material nature. Now, the more complete description, because this is just a little summary, really. It's given in the Bhagavatam 11th canto. Now listen to this. Uddhava says to Krishna, my dear Lord, how many different elements of creation have been enumerated by the great sages? I have heard you personally describe a total of 28. God, the jiva soul, the mahatattva, false ego, the five gross elements, the 10 senses, the mind, the five subtle objects of perceptions, and the three modes of nature. That's a more complete description of the thing. So this is part of a larger categorical scheme. But some authorities say there are 26 elements, while others cite 25, or else 7, 9, 6, 4, or 11, or even others say that there are 17, 16, or 13. What did each of these sages have in mind when he calculated the creative elements in such different ways? So, supreme, eternal, kindly, explain this to me. Huh? 11th Canto, chapter 22, I'm starting at text 3. Lord Krishna replied, because all material elements are present everywhere, it is reasonable that different learned brahmanas have analyzed them in different ways. All such philosophers spoke under the shelter of my mystic potency, and thus they could say anything without contradicting the truth. When philosophers argue, I don't choose to analyze this particular case in the same way that you have. It is simply my own insurmountable energies that are motivating their analytical disagreements. By interactions of my energies, different opinions arise, but for those who have fixed their intelligence on me and controlled their senses, differences of perception disappear, and consequently the very cause for argument is removed. Because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another. So there's a deeper reason. Because subtle and gross elements mutually enter into one another. Because the gross are contained within the subtle and they evolve outward according to the scheme. Philosophers may calculate the number of basic material elements in different ways according to their personal desire. And he goes on like that. And then he describes the different ones, different numbers. And he says, thus great philosophers, I'm ending with text 25, have analyzed the material elements in many different ways. All of their proposals are reasonable, since they are all presented with ample logic. Indeed, such philosophical brilliance is expected of the truly learned. Nasavrishi yata matana dinam. No one can be considered a great thinker who doesn't have his own opinion different from everybody else's. But anyway, Krishna recognizes that you can divide up the pie in all kinds of different ways according to your desire. I'm not arguing about that. But what I'm saying is here we do have one scheme that is given to us by Krishna for our guidance on the path of self-realization. And when I'm talking about faith, it means having confidence to use this scheme as the framework for our activity. Anyway, Krishna continues, we saw the first, this is earth, air, fire, water, ether, my separated material energies. Besides these, there is another superior energy of mine which comprises the living entities who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature. The jivas. So on the one side you have matter, material energy, and the other side you have the jivas. And then he says, all created beings have their sources in these two natures. Everything you see in the world is created by a confluence, a flowing together, of these material elements and the conscious jivas. According to this scheme, the jivas are irreducible. They're fundamental entities. You can't break them down. Now, material science wants to take as their paradigm, as basically there's earth, water, fire, air, ether. Maybe mind, they'll worry about that later. They can't figure out what to do with it yet. But basically what we call material science or mechanistic science is a basic thing that there are just simply structures of matter. And that in the course of time, these structures of matter become more complicated. By structures of matter, they mean anything, any phenomenon in the world that can be expressed in terms of numbers. You can weigh it or measure it or somehow or other you express it in terms of numbers, then science can deal with it. And that's all that there is. There's a methodological assumption that we have a tool, and there's an assumption that actually our tool fits all reality. But in a way, they're making reality conform to the tool rather than, in other words, if we can't deal with it, hey, it doesn't exist. You know, so that's their assumption. There's earth, water, fire, air, ether, and that's all. And then somehow or other, they've got to explain the fact of consciousness. Which this is where it seems to me their paradigm starts to become inadequate. Now see, for dealing with earth, water, fire, air, and ether, great, you know, no problem. The problem isn't that the paradigm is useless. It's useful, certainly. Otherwise you wouldn't have, you know, Hondas and atomic bombs and jet fighters and acrylic paints and all those wonderful things. No, I enjoy the benefits of modern civilization sometimes. It's useful. But then there's this act of kind of hubris that wants to say, then that's all that there is. You know? And then you have to explain how somehow or other all you have is structures of matter. Over the course of time, these structures of matter get more and more complicated. How that happens is another thing. It just seems to be the nature of things. Somehow or other, there's an anti-entropic system, and things get more complicated. And then, somewhere along the line, they get sufficiently complicated, but then something else pops into existence, which is not just structures of matter, which is the experience of structures of matter. You can't reduce it. It's not just another measurable thing, but somehow or other that's there. This is just by way of showing that Krishna's paradigm is not only are there these structures of matter, but fundamentally and irreducibly and always there was the experience of structures of matter. It didn't come out of there. So you have these two kinds of energies coming together. And then he says, of all that is material and all that is spiritual in this world, know for certain that I am both the origin and the solution. And then, mata parataram nanya kinchinasti. And beyond me, there's nothing more. That's it. There you have it. All of reality. Everything for now. There's matter, and there's spirit, and there's the source of both. That's the whole ontology. That's all that there is. So he does it. He says he's going to do it, and he does it. And Prabhupada very nicely put it in a slogan for us. He says, both life, first he said, life comes from life. And then he said, life and matter come from life. Both life and matter come from life. So, you know, physicists want to have a formula they can write on a t-shirt. Well, there it is. Both life and matter come from life. That's the super condensed version. So naturally you can elaborate it more, and it does get elaborated more in different places, but Krishna's just giving us a kind of sketch of what there is. So following this sketch, now we can understand my place in the scheme of things and how to look at this world. When I look at this world, I should see there's Krishna and there's living entities and there's matter. That's a scheme. A categorical scheme. And then this scheme, then it's, as Prabhupada puts it forward, he says that Krishna doesn't speak these things in the Bhagavad Gita for the amusement of armchair philosophers. I think that's his expression. He said, rather, it is for the formation of character. Bildung. Huh? For the formation of character. And this I noticed right away, actually, when I became a devotee, the one thing I counted is, you know, Prabhupada dropping in this notion of a soul, which I had been taught to dismiss as a metaphysical entity. In other words, it's not a legitimate subject of discourse because no sense experience could possibly be relevant to its truth or falsity and things like that. But And then after I kind of, well, okay, Prabhupada says soul, I'll start thinking about what a soul is again, you know. And gradually it started to make sense, you know, that the soul is actually experienceable because it's me, you know. And that it's, you know, just the fact that there's somebody here, you know, this is an object, and it's in no way a subject. It has no significance for itself. But here, this body is an object in this world, but it's also a subject. It has significance for itself. It undergoes experiences. There's a difference. And just the capacity for being aware and undergoing experiences is what it means to be a soul. So not only do I experience the soul, it's the condition of my having any experiences whatsoever. How could people miss that? How could philosophers not see this entity is here? Anyway, they've managed to do it. Because if your paradigm doesn't let you see it, it goes right by, even though it's the most obvious of things. Because a paradigm tells us what to look for. It shows us what to see and what not to see. Anyway, then I had to deal with this fact that I was familiar with a vast library of material on the body, what's called the mind-body problem. Western thinking, usually mind and soul are used interchangeably. The subtle body and the soul are not very well distinguished. So there's a whole mind-body problem or soul-body problem. There's a huge literature on this. And the other thing I thought, oh my God, you know, another addition to this shelf of literature. I mean, there's dualism, so many theories are there, psychophysical, pre-established harmony, materialism, idealism, the double aspect theory, epiphenomenalism, and everybody's got their little theory about how they come together. But, and you could think of going on and saying, oh, maybe this one is right, maybe that, and putting Prabhupada's idea or Krishna's idea is another one to stick in this list of shelves. But we're not to accept it in that way. It's for the formation of character. It's a guide to activity. We're supposed to, and that's why you have to have a commitment to this idea. Not just because it's one theory. This is the mental platform. We throw up theories, we play with them a while, we look at them, oh, that's nice, that's pretty. This is good about it, that's bad. And now we're tired of playing with this one, let's try this one, you know. This is the mental platform, putting up theories and bringing them down again. This is what Prabhupada put this forth as a guide for action, that is to say, as a guide for self-realization. We now understand ourselves from this description that I am not this body. Now you can say, well, to be a Krishna conscious devotee, one of our doctrines is that you have to believe in, is that I am not this body. Well, that just fills me with boredom and a lack of interest. Just this, you know, the theory, I am not this body. And one more theory among mothers, what difference does it make? But the point of understanding ourselves not this body is not just to have that theory, but to experience ourselves as spirit soul. This is realized knowledge. And that's why one became interested, at least I became interested in Krishna consciousness, was this prospect of self-realization. So there's this commitment to action. In order for there to be self-realization, in order to experience myself as not this body, I have to start doing certain things. At least this picture of the world, of the soul, the subtle body, the gross body, Krishna, material nature, it allows me to see a coherent picture in which becoming free from material bondage is a prospect. And now let me put it into action. Let me engage in now the behaviors based on this paradigm and see if it works or not. Well, why do I do that? Well, a lot of big people have said it, you know. Ramanuja and Shankaracharya and the great sages of the past, and there's Prabhupada and there's these other devotees. And I tell you, the other big thing is I'm simply attracted. An act of faith is an attraction. I'm simply attracted. When I saw devotees, I thought, I want to be like them. Not all of them. I want to be like them. And Prabhupada said, Ranchor mentioned that, and I saw other places that Prabhupada said his devotee means that when you see him, you want to be just like him. Now, why should there be an attraction? Well, I can explain that attraction in terms of the paradigm that I already accept. That a devotee, what is it about him attracts me? Well, I think what I saw in devotees was a certain amount of buoyancy. that comes from freedom from material attachment. And a buoyancy that was there, when I first met devotees, their lives were very, very hard. They had no money and still don't, but they had even less. But their lives were very, very difficult. And they were going all the time. And there was no, you know, no big sense of strain. They were just happy. And I could see here was some kind of happiness that eerily did not depend upon material conditions. In fact, they're doing everything to make them miserable. No illicit sex, no intoxication, no meeting. And they, the more they did it, the happier they became. So somehow or other, that was really attractive to me. Now, I guess it won't attract everybody. And I remember once when Tamal Krishna Goswami came to our to Philadelphia with the Radha Damodar bus when it first got started. And I used to sit down on the college campus and play music. They had a very nice bhajan band. You've heard the tape of Vishnu Janan, maybe. It was bhajan band. They sit out at the Temple University campus. The bus broke down, so they were there for almost a month. And they play this bhajan band, and they would serve out prasadam. It was a plate with some potato sabji and a puri and some halava and some juice. The same thing every day. And these kids would come, and they get a plate, and they sit down and listen to music. And Tamal Krishna Goswami, he showed me what he did. He went around to each person sitting there, and he said, "Do you like the food? Do you like the music?" And if they said, "Yeah, it's great," he would talk to them. If they said, "No," he'd go on to the next person. He said, "Why do I waste my time?" So he looked for some preliminary attraction to Krishna. That was Shraddha. It was just there. And otherwise, you could sit somebody who's not particularly attracted, you can sit and argue with them and you can defeat them, and they'll still say. In fact, this is what I did. I did it with some kid, you know. Said, "How do you like it?" "I don't like it so much, you know. Why are you in school?" I want to be an engineer, and, you know, he had a whole lifestyle planned out. And I don't know. I proved to him logically that there was no knowledge in all the books in that library or something, you know. It was just an argument. And he said, "All right," he said, "you've convinced me." He said, I can't defeat you," he said, "but I'm still not interested." And there it was, you know. So you may say this is not a rational thing, this shraddha, this attraction, that's the beginning of spiritual life. But at least we can account for it, I think, why it's there, when it's there, where it comes from. But we see that all these souls, they have their histories and they have their past and their karma. So we can account for this phenomena. Some people are attracted, some people are not attracted. Somebody, you know, coming in from some other paradigm, you know, some psychological thing would try to figure out. Although I don't think anyone has really been able to figure out what psychological fluke all devotees have in common yet. But somebody, I'm sure, has tried to do that. So anyway, that's how this process of Krishna consciousness works. So one becomes intelligent in a certain way. And we accept this paradigm as a guide for action. And we discover that if we actually follow it, we begin to undergo certain changes. And those changes have been described to us. Now, when Prabhupada describes this process in the seventh chapter, when he's talking about this knowledge, he says, "Here, by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt." That's what he says, know me in full. And then he says this interesting phrase, free from doubt. Now you can make a case that any knowledge is subject to doubt, like empirical knowledge. But Krishna wants to say that there's some kind of knowledge that is actually so, how should we say, immediate or certain that it's actually indubitable. And then In his discussion of this knowledge, this verse, this is the first verse of the seventh chapter, Prabhupada quotes these verses from the Bhagavatam 1:17-21, Srinivata Swakata Krishna, Punya Sravana Kirtana. And so that describes that the Krishna Katha, the narrations about Krishna, the words of Krishna, or about Krishna, or by Krishna, have a certain potency. And that potency is they clear away dirty things from the heart when they are properly heard and chanted. And then it says, if you regularly engage in this Bhagavata Sevaya, Prabhupada says regularly attending Bhagavatam class and serving the Bhagavata devotee, the dirty things in the heart are cleansed away almost to nil. Then he identifies those dirty things, rajas and tama, the effects of modes of passion and the modes of ignorance. So what we've been given in this categorical scheme is this way of seeing the world in terms of the three modes of material nature. That is a very fundamental category. Rajas, tamas, and so the whole Bhagavad Gita is full of it. And there's a chapter in which says if you just understand this by philosophical speculation, you can go back to Godhead. Here's something that happens, like the idea that of the three modes of nature. Now, I took a number of Hinduism courses in graduate school, and I could never figure out what they were talking about. And I had very good teachers, and they kept talking, they would mention the strands, guna. You can translate as a rope or a strand of nature. It wasn't intelligible until I read Prabhupada. He uses the word mode. And mode can mean a way of acting. And it starts off with experience that anybody has. We see that in this world, things are being created, things are being maintained, and things are being destroyed. That's the cycle of things. They build up, they last, and they fall apart. But that's all of our experience. I mean, that's just, anybody has that experience. But what Krishna does is now say, this is really important. This activity that things are being created, things are being maintained, and things are being destroyed, this is a fundamental category for you to understand the nature of things. Now, we wouldn't know that. Now, you could take that fact and, you know, it's any material science knows these things are going on, but they don't become fundamental categories of understanding. And then Krishna goes on to tell us that these three modes act on us, we become conditioned by them, and they determine our psychophysical makeup. It's such a fundamental category that the system of varnas is based on this three modes of material nature. And in fact, the way creation takes place is originally there's this primordial stuff, you know, this original matter, undifferentiated gloop, and it's zapped with the glance of Krishna in the form of the time energy. The three modes come out, and then there's false ego and goodness, passion, and ignorance, those three modes, and then boom, everything comes out of there. So the three modes are there right from the beginning. They are one of the first things to manifest out of the primordial substance. So, very fundamental category. And what we do in Krishna consciousness is we it's just like taking glasses and we put them on and suddenly we can see, oh, there's goodness, there's passion, there's ignorance. Before we read this, we didn't know what goodness was, passion was, ignorance. And we have to know. Why? Because our spiritual progress is judged by how much the effects of passion and ignorance disappear from the heart. Because this is the clinical test. If you follow the process of Krishna consciousness correctly, the first sign will be that lust and greed and anger begin to diminish. This is an experienceable clinical symptom that should take place. I remember one lecture Prabhupada was talking about that. He said, are lust and greed going away? If not, you're doing something wrong. You don't need to get a diploma?
Yeah. He said you don't need to go to college and get a degree to see if you're becoming Krishna conscious. He says you just have to see, are you becoming free from lust and greed?
Yeah, so there's a test. And so we apply it. And one thing that keeps us in the movement early on, we haven't had a lot of spiritual experience. The first thing that convinced me, I just started chanting and these things began to go down. That's what I wanted. Now, if you don't want that, then you're not going to do it. But if for some reason or other you want that, either somebody convinces you it's a good thing or you already thought... I thought it was a good thing, actually. I had been reading Buddhism and I became convinced that the cause of our suffering are our desires. So I wanted to become free from material desires and I had devotees and they said, you have to chant. So I started chanting and then the material desires began to diminish. In fact, the first thing was that it worked so well and so fast. I don't know how much I was chanting. I just sat down and I just chanted, I don't know, half an hour a day. It went away so fast that I got really scared. And I stopped chanting because I didn't know who these people were, what this sound was, what I was doing. And I could see it was heavy. I had to check it out before I went any further. I felt I was in the grip of something very powerful. But this is experience. Now somebody will say, oh, it's subjective. Well, all experience is the experience of people, and therefore, or of subjects, and therefore it's subjective. So does it mean that it's completely private to me? No, you take the beads, and we can, enough people will have the same experience that we can say, yeah, we all have the same experience. And that's, I guess, what people mean by objective. You have to make yourself the subject of experiments. You can't just do funny things to rats in cages and chop them up afterwards and see what happened. So you do it to yourself. But that doesn't remove it from the realm of experience. So, these are the kinds of things that begin to happen to devotees. And therefore, the initial shraddha, or commitment, or faith, which was tentative, because of this kind of thing, becomes stronger. And of course, advancement in Krishna consciousness, one way of measuring it is whether one's shraddha is weak or medium or very strong. And that commitment gets stronger and stronger because one has undergone successfully the process of Krishna consciousness. So this is one way this is the way that we adopt and we are given a path like this. Certain things make it, it comes down, one thing that Prabhupada told us is that we have to just accept it as it's given. Actually, he said, otherwise things get really messed up. He said, one thing he said that I perceived was important very early on, Prabhupada said about scripture or Shastra, he says, if you doubt one thing, you can doubt the whole thing. Now I was in a part of a religion department while I watched people doubting like crazy. One of the professors there later became one of my dissertation directors had just written a book called The Secular Meaning of the Gospels. And it was an attempt to have, some kind of afterglow of Christianity while not believing in any of it. And, there was one of the Death of God theologians, Paul Van Buren, in fact, the religion department at that time was made up mostly of various sorts of priests, ministers, nuns, and rabbis who were leaving their institutions and coming to the religion department. Those religion departments many sometimes now have a lot of Hare Krishna devotees in them too. They're the same thing. They were busy, you know, in various ways, saying this part of the scripture this we can accept and this part we reject. This has been going on for some time. Well, you make yourself the here you are. We come to this process because we need some guidance and some help under an authority who knows what he's doing. The first thing we do is make ourselves the authority. I come because I'm in need of help. I'm contaminated. I'm locked in material nature. And now I'm going to say, well, this part I accept. Prabhupada said you have to accept the whole thing. So there was a lot to swallow. I didn't come, you know, to this movement to believe that the moon is further than the sun, or even in demigods or simple, believable things like that. But he said it is what you accept it. And so, okay. In fact, the first real crisis I had, I wrote Prabhupada, I'm thinking of doing a doctoral dissertation, thinking of a subject that he had any suggestion. He wrote back, he said, defeat Darwin. And I went, oh God, what have I gotten into? Defeat Darwin, you know. You know, I'd seen that movie, Inherit the Wind, about, you know, all I could think about is these some of these born-again Christians, you know. But anyway, that's... Darwin happens to be actually in some ways the linchpin of another paradigm. And Prabhupada was quite right. So this is all described, you know, what is day? What is daylight to us? We act in this way, we take this paradigm as our guide, cultivate a form of knowledge and associate with devotees, and certain things that we see things certain way. So someone asked Prabhupada, "Have you seen Krishna?" And he said, "So have you." But have you seen the sun? Have you seen the moon? What did he mean? They can see, but they can't recognize. I mentioned earlier, talking about Saint Augustine, how there can be cognition without recognition. So I said, you know, have you seen the sun? Have you seen the moon? So sometimes people can't see. So it's a way that devotees will live in one world. So it's like a map. We have a map and of the world that's given to us, and that's a map that's given to us for our spiritual realization, where we've accepted that as the highest goal. The same territory can have different maps. You can have a territory with a road map. And you could have a same territory, the map of mineral deposits or something else. This is maps of the same territory and therefore doing different things. Of course, part of our preaching case is to persuade people that what you ought to do, the business of your life, you will not be happy unless you engage in self-realization. And I said that is not really... although reason and argument go into that, it's not entirely. The decision is something more than just a decision based within a framework, but it's a decision to accept a whole other framework. Anyway, maybe a few minutes for questions. Anyone has any? We're continuing tomorrow. This is a... Yeah.
Sometimes we present our philosophy not just as Christian or smart heart religion, but we present as the absolute truth.
Yeah, I accept it as the absolute truth.
In an objective way, we can say that this paradigm allows us to understand all the others. It's like instead we say that we need that paradigm. It's an instrument that by which we can understand everything.
I think what we look for in accepting some kind of categorical scheme or paradigm is, logic or science, philosophy, you would look for a system to be sound and complete. Sound means free from internal contradiction, and complete means being able to account for all kinds of phenomena, not just those phenomena which you select out. And to me, I mean, as far as philosophies of spiritual life, no, I think my conviction is so far Krishna consciousness does that. At least, actually, when I first encountered Krishna consciousness and I began to see all the ramifications of that were there, it looked to me as though that Krishna consciousness was the original religion, and every other religion I'd ever studied or encountered had taken some part of it and run with it. So I was, of course, I was looking in a context just involving religious things. So, as we can see, to me, we can deal with other things. Some people's behavior is explicable in terms of the modes of passion. Some people's behavior is explicable in modes of ignorance. Some in the modes of goodness. So that, to me, Krishna consciousness does have those characteristics of freedom from internal contradiction and complete. Of course, you never have all experience. You never see everything. But I'm happy with it. Yeah.
Just on this point, I think there's...
Maybe you should come up and speak into this.
Just on this point of acceptance of the paradigm, especially in questions of spiritual realization or spiritual quests, the most fundamental thing that I see there is you accept or reject the paradigm in terms of how you see yourself fitting into it. And that brings back to this point that you made about the map. Mm-hmm. The map that Krishna gives has that very one fundamental point that makes any map work if you're looking to get to a destination. In other words, if you go to a town or a suburb in a town and there's the map of everything that's there and there's a grid reference that tells you, you know, such and such a street is at A7 and another one is at B4, and so you see that's a paradigm of that's a model of this part of the city or the town. But the thing that makes it workable for you is the arrow that says you are here. And the first thing that comes in Krishna consciousness is very nicely illustrated in Hari Suri's diary, where he explains how the first time Srila Prabhupada began to speak to him in a personal and private way while he was massaging him, he said to Hari Suri, "So do you understand our philosophy?" And Hari Suri said, "Yes." So Prabhupada said, "So explain." And Hari Suri began saying, "Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead." And then he gave a dissertation of the philosophy. And Prabhupada didn't interrupt him. He listened to everything he said. And then when Hari Suri had finished, he said, "First you tell them who they are. Then you tell them who Krishna is." And that's how Krishna begins his teachings to Arjuna. He says, "You are the soul." And for myself, that was the blinding thing that happened. You know, 3 o'clock in the morning after working until midnight, coming home, sitting trying to read Bhagavad Gita, I'd waded through the first chapter and all these names of all these people and this battle and this place. It was like, what's this all about? And then I started reading the second chapter, and then we get into the soul. And I suddenly realized, I'm the soul. So I suddenly located myself in the paradigm.
Yeah. So that's a good point, because what happens, people who become devotees, although you start with a question that you're suffering. Why am I suffering? That question's on your mind. And then when you learn this business about the soul and the body and I'm not this body, there's a diagnosis given. This is why you're suffering, because you've identified yourself falsely with the material body. And anything, any remedy short of that is not going to solve your problems, because your basic problems are birth, death, old age, and disease. Now, there's some people who are resistant to thinking about birth, death, old age, and disease. They'd much prefer to think that their problem is, I don't have enough money. And they're kind of militantly shallow because they're actually avoiding dealing with the realities of life. But somebody who does, and then he starts to see, these are the ultimate problems, what can I do? So those people become devotees are those to whom this picture of things and their location in the picture had an appeal to them. And you're quite right about that. And there's a sort of conviction, and then you try it on for size, you see what it feels like, you do some of the practices that it recommends, and then you see if it works or doesn't work. Everyone, I think, proceeds in a somewhat tentative, hesitant way, and tries it, and gives it up, and tries it again.
But the fact is, you can always locate yourself.
Yeah,
and you
that's
always
quite true.
Know where you are in relationship to the destination, and what the next step is.
Then for people like me, other things happen. Like I begin to realize, here's this analysis of people's spiritual experience in terms of karma, jnana, and bhakti. And then I saw that's a tool by which I could understand not just religious phenomena, but spiritual, human spiritual development in all kinds of different phases. And then that's when you take a paradigm and you start to articulate it in different areas, and it's rewarding. Things come about, you start to see a certain spiritual dialectic at work in all kinds of different places. So then I write a couple of papers about it, and I show it to some people, and they say, hey, yeah. And, you know,